Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans, in our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. In case you haven't noticed, there's a lot of very powerful women who are getting the job done these days. Some, like Popeye's CEO Cheryl Batchelder, do it through a personal philosophy developed over time. Cheryl is an advocate of what she calls servant leadership in her book, Dare to Serve. Jill Pratt, the first ever female general manager of Zatarain's, has had to adapt to an entire new food culture while managing one of the largest manufacturing facilities in Louisiana. And it's no coincidence that restaurateur Joanne Clevenger of The Upper Line is a success. Joanne has parlayed her determination and will into multiple businesses over her lifetime. Wait till you hear how she changed Louisiana law with no more than a simple French Quarter flower cart. We're celebrating girl power with some powerful women on this week's Louisiana Eats.
This is Joanne Clevenger. I'm the owner and sort of general manager of the Upper Line Restaurant here in New Orleans. I opened in January 1983, and I'm really proud to still be around.
To the New Orleans community, Joanne Clevenger is much more than a restaurateur. She's a local fixture and a living legend. In 2015, the Southern Foodways Alliance honored her with the Craig Claiborne Lifetime Achievement Award for her community stewardship and contributions to the hospitality industry. But her remarkable career didn't begin in food. Here, Joanne shares stories of a journey twisted and turned through multiple incarnations before she established the Upper Line in 1983. Joanne, you are such an amazing woman. It's very hard for me to know where to begin. But let's begin with the fact that you are not a native New Orleanian.
That's right, Puppy. I am Louisiana. I really am Louisiana. You know, I tell people Louisiana is the least homogenized state in all of the USA. It's so many different kinds of communities. And you go 50 miles and you say, wow. What happened to the jambalaya? Where we bit? When I was a little girl, I was born in Alexandria, Louisiana, and my grandmother did not allow us to eat crawfish, but she put a little piece of bacon on the string, and we could go down to the ditch and catch them, but we had to give them away across the neighbor, to the neighbor folks who were Catholic, and they ate crawfish. My grandpa used to talk, when he talked about New Orleans, he would say, those Frenchies. So I grew up in a very different part of Louisiana, but all of Louisiana is what is contributing to what we call Creole. Not just the Cajun land, but North Louisiana, Shreveport, Jonesville, Alexandria, Bunky, all these places and their food mores and their food knowledge have contributed to what we in New Orleans call Creole.
So what brought you to New Orleans?
Oh, it's a sad story. My mother was ill, and I was 17, and I came down here to be with her and try to help her.
Oh, dear.
I lived at the hospital, charity hospital, for a year while I went to the war in Easton on the streetcar every day. I won a scholarship to Tulane, but then she died that first spring when I was in college, and my life sort of fell apart. So I got a job, and I moved to French Quarter, and I met a great group of interesting people, married an intellectual French Quarter bohemian who had many friends who were artists and chefs and writers, and had two little children, was very poor, like I was when I was growing up.
Well, that was the bohemian lifestyle, after
all. You know, I was really influenced in food by my grandfather and my grandmother. My father hunted and fished, and we ate what he caught and what he shot. My grandfather, my most vivid memory, is a mule and a plow. But we had good food, and it was well prepared. And so when I came to New Orleans and married Max and was exposed to the French market, that all the wholesale fish people, the produce people were down here, Solari's, all the restaurants, my brain just did all kinds of flip-flops because I didn't even know that people ate shrimp when they were cold. I thought they were just fried. And I certainly had never seen a little oval platter. In all the cafeterias, the A&G cafeteria, everybody had a shrimp roomelot. And they were always on a little tiny oval platter. And I became obsessed with them. And I think that's what led to my great discovery later at the Upper Line, where I finally figured out to put shrimp roomelot on top of a fried green tomato. I put in a little oval platter.
Joanne, you have had so many different careers besides restaurateur that you seem to be a cat with more than nine lives.
I'm just really lucky. And you know, part of my luck, a big part of my luck, is being born to a family that love to take books and food and going to good public schools. But being raised in North Louisiana with that Protestant work ethic and always show up for the meeting, you come to the Big Easy and you always show up for the meeting on time, you get to do things.
What are some of the surprising things that people may not know about your varied career?
In my 20s, I was a waitress and helped manage a restaurant on Bourbon Street. That's how I learned about restaurants. And then I opened a little folk music bar next to your father's mustache while I kept my job at Rizzo's Italian restaurant. And it was just a carriageway, but it was very wonderful. Joni Mitchell came in once and sang for us. Joe Cocker filmed part of his movie, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, in there. When Richie Havens was in town, he would come in and sing for us, Here Comes the Sun. And while I was there, I started a little flower cart business, and the state sued me.
Yes, the flower cart business caused you to revolutionize the cut flower business in Louisiana.
In Louisiana, because the laws that had been passed in the early 60s made it very difficult to sell even a single daisy or carnation. And the judge let me bring the flower cart up to the bench, and he declared the law to be arbitrary and capricious. But that only found for me, actually. It didn't apply to other people similarly situated. So I got on my high horse, and I helped write legislation, creating something called Cut Flower Dealer, and I lobbied it through Baton Rouge. I put a flower, a carnation, on every legislator's desk. I took my two children and the flower cart to Baton Rouge. The newspapers and the TV took it up as Mom, Apple Pie, and Flower Girls. We won. It created something that made it possible to buy a single flower or a bunch of flowers without having elaborate apprenticeship, without taking an elaborate test to show your ability to make a funeral wreath. I'm really proud of that because I think it brought flowers in an easy way for many, many people all over Louisiana.
You couldn't walk into a grocery store today and buy a bouquet of flowers if it weren't for Joanne Clevenger.
Well, somebody else might have done it later, but yes, that's right.
Come on down to the Mermaid Cafe and I will buy you a bottle of wine.
I opened Andy's. That was a little folk music bar. But I couldn't make any money because the rent was so high, so I couldn't quit my job. So I decided to open another bar where the rent wasn't so high. And I found a place on Decatur Street, and the rent was only $300 as opposed to $1,000. And I bought the lease from an ex-Filipino yo-yo champion.
You're making that up.
No, he used to yo-yo up and down the sidewalk in front, but not enough people came. So I bought his lease, and my husband, Max Clevenger, helped me to put all this stained glass in there, and I built the back bar. And we called it the Abbey. And the way that people thought I was nuts, because Decatur Street was pretty sleazeville then.
No man's land.
That's right. It really was. And I brought in Guinness on tap, which no one in Southeast United States had done. I had to pay for the storage. But the big thing was I brought in the New York Times on Sundays. You used to have to wait till Tuesday to get your Sunday paper. And so every Sunday morning, I'd drive to the airport, pick up the bundle of papers they'd put on the plane, go to Bill Long's to get bread and cheese, and bring it all back to Decatur Street. and I had the most amazing, eclectic group of people, including Turner Catledge, who had been the managing editor of the Times, and Mrs. Stern from Longview Gardens, and the Times-Picayune people, and Mayor Dutch Morio. So it was just this eclectic, amazing bar crowd. And then I decided to get out of bars and restaurants, and I opened a vintage clothing store, and I was splitting up with my husband at the time, so he took the Abbey, and I took my little flower carts down the next block of Decatur Street, and I opened a vintage clothing store and kept doing the flowers for a little while. And one of my first customers that first couple of months was Paul McCartney and his wife.
Oh, that was rough.
They used to stay at the Richelieu, which was down there around the corner. It was a day where it wasn't very busy, and they were just looking for ties. Old ties. And they bought some ties. I said, "Ooh, I like this. This is great."
It's pretty exciting. Brings a beetle in.
I love the search for it. My mother took in sewing when I was growing up. And I love fabric. I love the hunt for treasure. Old clothes that other people had treasured enough to save. And I felt like I was rescuing their treasures. And then washing them and ironing them. And then someone else come along and put more love into it. And so it was a very lovely, what I call a benevolent circle. And I really loved it. Probably still be doing it, except for accidentally finding out the building where we are was for sale. But the crazy thing about the old clothes store was that I inadvertently became a costume designer. Fernella Bonnerice wrote a show called One More Time. And where I went for breakfast every day, Vaucresson Creole Café, he was my waiter, and he got all the performers, the band, the sound guy, to work for free. And he came to my shop and asked me if I'd help him with the costumes. I said, "Vernell, I don't know how to do that." He said, "I'll help you." I said, "Okay." So we put on a play, right? At one point, we had 5 casts around the world.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It was an incredible learning curve for me. I got to see the Queen in London shake hands with the New Orleans cast while they were wearing my costumes.
Incredible.
And I did get good reviews.
So there you are in your vintage clothing store, happy as a clam.
Yeah, I was actually.
And a building uptown comes up for sale. What possessed you to change course again?
I was looking for a way to open a second store near the universities. And I had looked at the building for rent that's now Crepe Nanou. And then it was in poor condition. They wanted $1,000 a month's rent. And it was very tiny. And I was driving past Kirsch's Jeans Barbecue Restaurant on my way back to the quarter. And it said, "For a lease." So I said, "Well, let me just compare rents to see if they're crazy about the rent at this little shop. Or I'm crazy." So I called when I got back to the quarter. And the lady said, "Oh, it's no longer for lease. Today, the owners decided to sell the building." And all the years I've been this serial entrepreneur, I never could afford a building. When the buildings were 50, I could only never think of it. By the time I could afford 50,000, they'd gone to 111. And the first thought when she said it was for sale was, "How much?" So I said, "How much?"
That's great bargaining power.
And it was just the little tiny first room you come in. It was 112,000. And the first thought that went through my brain was, "I think I could do that."
Oh, gosh.
And I got so excited, I couldn't remember the word option. So I had this long, convoluted question about, "Whereby, if I gave you a certain amount of money, would you promise not to sell it to anybody?"
Oh.
So I persuaded my husband, that's my second husband, Alan Greenacre, to take a second mortgage on our house. He's an engineer. I persuaded my son, Jason Clevenger, to quit his job as a head chef at Cafe Sabiza's. We bought the building, we did the work, we cleaned it all out. And we opened January 83 with 40 chairs and no money for the first week's payroll.
When we come back from a short break, Joanne Clevenger tells us of her journey to become the restaurateur and hospitality leader she is today. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Brennan's Restaurant. Breakfast at Brennan's, featuring Chef Slade Rushing's updated classic Creole cuisine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and private events at 417 Royal Street in the historic French Quarter. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Joanne Clevenger, whose journey to become owner of the Upper Line in 1983 took her down many paths. We continue as she opens her new business.
Of course, there were very few uptown restaurants then, and so we got a nice honeymoon. Gaucho's had just opened two or three months beforehand. Crepe Nanou opened shortly after we opened. Clancy's opened a few months later. So here were four new restaurants, all of them uptown. Susan Spicer with Savoir Faire opened a little bit later. So there was quite a boom, all of a sudden.
Synergy, all of a sudden happening.
And it was exciting. My son was very well organized. He got us in Gourmet Magazine. But you know how we got in Gourmet Magazine?
How?
Ella Brennan brought Ellen Brown to lunch. And Ellen Brown was doing a story about New Orleans restaurants. And she included Commanders and us. And I think the other one might have been Bayona. So, I mean, I owe so much to Ella, not just for that particular instance, but the inspiration that she and other restaurant tours and chefs, women, have started a path that the rest of us can follow without as many obstacles as they had. When I was living on Charter Street in 1959, downstairs where Doris Metropolitan is now was a wonderful, crazy restaurant called Dottie Rieger's. And it was owned and run by a lady with red hair piled up on her head, and I would be so admiring of her when I saw her. I didn't have enough money to eat there, but I would look in, and they had a grand piano. And late at night, when they were having movies made in town, Frankie Lane and people like that would gather around the piano at 1 a.m. and sing songs, and opera songs, and popular songs. It was a very wonderful, exhilarating time. And I think I was very inspired by Dottie Rieger. I was inspired by the food that I grew up with, my mother and my grandmother, and the way they took care of food and they put it up in jars so we could have it in the winter. And so food has just been part of my heritage. And then seeing the food of New Orleans and Dottie Rieger and other women who had restaurants, the sisters of Delmonico's.
Absolutely.
Celestine Dunbar on Magazine Street. When we first opened, we had a charcoal grill. There were very few restaurants. Jason had put in a charcoal grill at Sabiza's before he left, and we had one, so we did grilled fish, which was very new on charcoal in New Orleans at that time. When I looked at a menu today from when we first opened, and some of the dishes we still have on the menu are there. They've evolved. We had a shrimp remoulade then. We have a shrimp remoulade now, but we put it on top of the fried green tomatoes. We had roast duck on our menu, and it's evolved. I've had 6 main chefs, and each of them is reflected on today's menu. And I'm really proud of that it's a collaborative effort. It's not one person that's driven this engine. It's a collaboration. The front of the house, the back of the house, all 6 of these chefs. Of course, the guests and their feedback and the media and the vendors, but it's not a single entity, not a single person that does it. It's a collaborative effort. I'm really good at coming up with ideas. I have a really good ability to taste things. And I also have the experience to know what some, not always, but sometimes what the guests will enjoy and whether it's practical to produce in the kitchen. Because no matter how many great dishes you think of, you've got to be able to produce it in the kitchen without disrupting the line. And the signature dishes now, 2 of them, well, I think the fried green tomatoes is the one that's the most famous because so many people have copied it. Now it's made millions of people happy. But after Katrina, there's 2 dishes that are on the menu that have proved to be extraordinarily popular. And the oyster St. Claude was actually inspired by Mandich's not reopening. And I wanted to have an oyster dish that would in some way pay tribute to them, because I thought their oysters were amazing. Oysters Manditch were amazing. I used to bring journalists there visiting us just for the oysters. And so Chef Ken Smith and I got that dish together. And so then the next dish was, I didn't want to go to France or England after Katrina, so my husband, Alan Greenacre, and my son, Jason Clevenger, we drove to Birmingham because Frank Stitt's restaurants had heard so much about him. And one of the restaurants we went to was the Hot and Hot Fish Club, Chris Hastings, who got a James Beard Award recently. And I was so intrigued by the name Hot and Hot Fish Club. I said, I'm going to invent a dish we can call Hot and Hot, because he didn't have one on the menu. So I did. And again, Chef Ken and I worked on that dish for weeks. And basically, it's two sauces. When we peel the shrimp, we save the shells, make a stock, reduce it to two sauces, in one of which we put jalapenos, the other we put habaneros. The habanero one's in a little silver container, so you have complete control. And both of them have been amazingly popular. I sincerely believe that if you put a parameter around trying to think of something, whether it's a costume for this theater or whether it's a dish for a menu, that it helps your brain to stretch. It has to be red. It has to be made for a very tall, large lady. Your brain does things that it wouldn't do. Is, I need a costume. And that's the way it was with the oyster St. Claude, the hot and hot shrimp. And it really was the way it was with the fried green tomatoes, too. Because when I heard they were going to make a movie about fried green tomatoes, I said, oh my gosh, we got to have a dish.
You really are the restaurant, Joanne. When people go to the Upper Line, if you were to not be there, I think they might just about fall down.
Well, I'm pretty consistent. I am. I think that's, again, that North Louisiana work ethic, you know, you get when you come from a poor family and a farm family. Farmers have to get up every day. They can't say, oh, well, today I think I'm going to lie in. The cows won't stand for it, baby. And I think that's part of my heritage. Going every day, even if you don't feel like it. But part of it also is being a waitress and learning to come out of myself, because before that I was a bookworm. And if you're a waiter or waitress, you have to become gregarious. You have to look at the guest as someone you want to enhance their experience. And when I finally found out about 25 years ago, the original meaning of the word restaurant, restorative, I was so relieved. Because it made sense, the whole thing. Again, it's a benevolent circle. We restore the guest, whether it's a diner or a hot dog stand or haute cuisine. If you do it right, your guests come in after the hassles of the day and you nourish them in spirit and body, and they go away stronger, braver, and enhanced. And that's a restorative.
Well, I have to say, I am not a person who likes dining alone. However, I could imagine what a lovely dining alone experience at the Upper Line it would be, because to just sit in your dining room and watch you in action is a bit of a treat, because no one eats at the Upper Line, no one dines at the Upper Line without having in some way the touch of Joanne Clevenger. You're always checking on everybody. You've got an eye on all the tables. I just think that in many ways you take hospitality to a level that we rarely see it in the world today.
I think you're right, but that, again, is a passion and a compulsion in a way, because I guess, Poppy, in some ways, I want the world to be a better place. And I'm not a school teacher, and I'm not a registered nurse or doctor, but in my own little way, I can help people to feel better about their lives for a little while and feel nurtured and celebratory, because restaurants celebrate life. They celebrate the occasion. They make occasions more memorable because of the hospitality and because of the shared experience. Sometimes I talk about restaurants are about strangers breaking bread together. And I think it makes us more tolerant of each other. And I think in the long run, it makes us more appreciative of our lives. And sometimes we forget that our lives are not a dress rehearsal. So I really think we should grab the day, live for today, and be of some good in the world. I also feel strongly about this, that Walmart, Target, CVS, all these places have eliminated so many small owner-operated businesses. And therefore, people, the general public, feels more and more anonymous. We're not individuals at Walmart. We're not individuals. Somebody doesn't recognize and say, hey, how y'all doing today? They don't care. Well, they act like they don't care. But the people that work the cash register at Target, they're different today from they were yesterday. So there's not that sense of community. Restaurants can provide a sense of community. So can beauty salons. You know, and Langenstein's does that because they have someone behind the counter that gives you a nod like they've seen you before. I think that's so terribly destructive to our society. I guess I'm not really as much a business person as I don't know what you'd call me, but I'm not really great at business. I managed to make it work, but mostly I'm great about wanting to accomplish a project, whether it's the costumes for the theater or buying books. I love to buy books. And the restaurant is sort of like a project to me where you bring the wait staff, the kitchen together. You have vendors that bring you things. And it's like theater in a way, I guess, because you've got the back of the house, the front of the house. And to put on the show every night at 5:30, the lights go down, the music comes up, and we are here to serve you and to make you happy.
With your over 30 years in the business now, Joanne, what do you hope that your legacy in this industry will be?
That the people that work with us over the years go on to have it make a difference in their lives. Because that's the other part of having a restaurant. You hire people, and sometimes you can nurture them into a place where they want to go. They didn't even realize they wanted to go. Our bartender has been with us over 20 years. African-American, he started as a dishwasher when he was a junior in high school. He was the most shy person I had ever met. And he has thrived and flourished, and he's an amazing bartender. And when we go out of town for holidays, he's the one who has to come. And if the burglar alarm goes off, he's the one who comes over. You know, I mean, we've been a niche for people. We had Ken Smith work for us for 20 years, 10 years learning to be a chef, 10 years as our chef. He left us 6 years ago to learn to be a Roman Catholic priest. At the age of 50, he left us. So it was a collaborative effort. We nurtured him, he nurtured us, but it was a niche for him before he went out into this other adventure in life. And so I think the legacy I want to think about is, what have we done for the people that work with us? And maybe also, what have we done for the people who are our guests and our customers? Because I know that we have a place in their hearts, and for some of them, because they'll come back and they haven't been in 20 years. And they say, oh, I'm so glad to see you. I was hoping so much you would be here. And so we have a place in other people's spirits and hearts. And that's good to know.
But Joanne, I'm so grateful that you took this time to sit down with us. And thank you so much for being our guest on Louisiana Eats and sharing your amazing story with us.
I'm a lucky person. I'm such a lucky person. Thank you, Poppy. It was a lovely thing to be with you.
Joanne Clevenger of the Upper Line Restaurant.
Happiness, more or less, it's just a change in me, something in my liberty, on my mind. Happiness coming and going.
My name is Jill Pratt, and I'm the general manager for Zatarain's.
Becoming a leader at a New Orleans institution like Zatarain's would be a daunting task for anyone, much less for someone new to the Crescent City. That's just what Jill Pratt set her sights on when she became Zatarain's general manager. Jill spoke with us about her experiences stepping into the role and the wealth of knowledge she's learned from Louisiana's home cooks. Jill began by telling us the story of the company's founder, Emile Zatarain, and his humble origins in the 19th century.
So Emile Zatarain started out when he was quite young. He started out as an apprentice in a local grocery store in 1882. Now, a few years later, in 1886, he purchased a grocery store and got married on the very same day. And while he was there, he had a food counter, like most other local stores, and he made his famous root beer. And over time, he found that that root beer was maybe more popular than his store. And in 1889, he started exclusively marketing his root beer extract and sold his grocery store.
So that was the original linchpin of the business. It actually was the root beer.
Absolutely. So the root beer was one of the things he sold, along with things like fireworks and pickled vegetables and a whole host of things, almost like a general store. But the root beer was the most popular thing in the store, and he realized that that might be an easier business maybe than managing all of those different products within a grocery store. And he continued to do that with his sons until his death in 1959 at the age of 97.
Coming here from out of town, have you been surprised at the proprietary sense that the general public has about your product?
You know, I sometimes think that I manage two brands here, Zatarain's in New Orleans and Zatarain's every place else, because the love and possessiveness almost about Zatarain's when
There's
you're in the
passion.
Local market, it's amazing. We actually did some research where we went into people's homes and cooked with them and just saw how they use Zatarain's. And we asked this question to one woman, and it was completely a hypothetical. It was, so what if Zatarain's picked up one day and just moved away? And she looked at me and almost started to cry. She goes, it can't do that. Zatarain's is ours, which I thought was really endearing. Now, of course, we are dedicated to the New Orleans area and just put a large investment into staying here because we believe that, you know, really having that authenticity within the cooking and really taking that culture and food and flavor of New Orleans and taking it outside is a great service to the brand. And we're also really dedicated to the New Orleans economy. So, of course, we would never leave, but it was really endearing to find out how much that thought was terrifying to some of the local consumers.
Tell me about your career path. How did you get here?
You know, career paths are never as linear as you think they're going to be. So I actually started out as an accountant out of college, and I did tax returns and audited financial statements. And then I worked in mergers and acquisitions to try to figure out how to make larger healthcare companies. And then I decided I didn't want to do any of that anymore. And, you know, I went back, got another degree, and I actually worked in cosmetics marketing for many years on the CoverGirl brand. And I moved over to McCormick in 2008, worked on their spice and extract brands, eventually became their vice president of marketing for the U.S., and then got the opportunity to move to Zatarain's and work down here. And it's just been a fantastic, you know, experience. I'd never had a plant and just a fully located facility to work with, and that's really been a fantastic experience.
What have been the greatest challenges?
You know, the greatest challenge in moving down here was really managing lots of things that I don't have any direct experience doing. So, you know, when I was moving through the ranks, say in marketing or when I was in finance earlier, it's not easy, but it's easier to manage people who are doing things you've done before. Then when you take a job where you're managing a general management experience, I'm managing people who, if push came to shove, I actually couldn't do it. You know,
couldn't do their job.
No, I couldn't do it. I am not an engineer. and I'm very willing to admit that. And so the ability to listen and just understand problems that you don't have direct experience in and how do you help and how do you step away, I think has all been a really interesting experience since I've been here. And everybody's been very supportive. You know, I thought having somebody from McCormick, from Baltimore move down here would be alienating to folks, and actually they welcomed me with open arms.
Has there ever been a female general manager at Zatarain's?
No, I'm actually the first female general manager down at Zatarain's. We also have a female plant manager, and it's the first time there's been a female plant manager as well. So, you know, one of the really exciting things about today is that you see more and more women in highly visible roles. And I think what's great about that is you have the opportunity to leverage just much more diversity of talent and personality when you have a wider pool to select from. Now, women, like men, have a lot of stuff going on, and so I always loved to cook. And so the idea of working in a really iconic food brand like Zatarain's and being able to talk about food during the day and then go home and cook that again at night is actually fantastic.
Tell me a little bit about how you bring New Orleans and the whole state of Louisiana outside of our local environs. How do you do that?
Well, New Orleans is a city that actually has a presence that's much bigger than the size. You know, when you talk about New Orleans to people who are maybe not from the United States, they might know New Orleans more than they would know Chicago or some other cities that are much larger. And people know it because they think it's super fun. So it's actually a really easy city, a town to talk about and to bring those food and flavors, because when people come to New Orleans, they have a great time and they want to know how they can recreate that in their kitchen at home. I will say one of the interesting things about our products is that when you talk to people who use them here, let's say they use jambalaya and they say, you know what I love about it is it's an easy way to get jambalaya on the table. I clean out my refrigerator, all the vegetables and proteins I have, and I throw them in with some jambalaya. And then you go to Chicago, where people also actually buy a lot of Zatarain's, and they look at that instruction panel and they follow it word for word for word. They say, oh, I got to brown some sausage. I'm going to brown some sausage. Now I got to put this in. There's none of that creativity where they take it and throw it all in together. They feel like following the instructions gets them authentic New Orleans meal. So we need to make sure that we are making the best products with the easiest instructions so people can do that at home, because our cuisine here, which seems so easy and natural, can be a little bit intimidating. Now, I know it's true, although I will say one of the things that's great about New Orleans is that food and the ability to cook is a point of pride. There's none of that cooking's a chore, the dinner dilemma that you hear about in a lot of places. I got to come home and what's for dinner? I went into a family's home right when I first started, and they were cooking dinner that night. They said, no, tonight's a fast dinner. They were cooking for an hour and 15 minutes. And the husband and the wife, they cooked together, and the kids got involved. Food is a fun sharing experience, and they didn't cook just for the four of them. They said, well, someone always stops by when we cook because I'm a great cook. And they cooked for 12, and when we were there, some neighbors knocked on the door, grabbed a paper plate, sat down on the couch. And so food is really a way here to bring people together, and not something that people feel like is an imposition or something they don't want to do. It's something they want to do, and they want to do it better than everybody else, which is a really great place to have a food brand.
Jill Pratt of Zatarain's.
What are all those spices in traditional Louisiana crab boil? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What are all those spices in traditional Louisiana crab boil? Well, that's a tightly kept secret at Zatarain's, but I've done some deciphering, and here's what I've identified. You'll note there's a brown spice element in crab boil, which comes from clove and allspice. There's also mustard seeds, coriander, celery seeds, black pepper, and of course, lots of spicy cayenne. Luckily, all those ingredients are assembled and bagged for our convenience at the Zatarain's plant in Algiers. But if you're ever stranded someplace without a bag of crab boil, at least now you can make a stab at it yourself. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Yeah! That's what a Popeye!
Well, how do we go?
Come on, and I'll show you.
Everywhere we go, people jump and shout. They all want to know what the Popeye's all about, so let's do it.
When I first met Cheryl Batchelder at a Popeye's event in New Orleans, I had no idea she was the company's CEO. That's because Cheryl is a true champion of servant leadership. The idea that powerful executives lead with the belief that they are not the most important person in the company. Cheryl delivered this theory of leadership in her acclaimed book, Dare to Serve: How to Drive Superior Results by Serving Others. Here's Cheryl to discuss just how she walks the walk.
Servant leadership is a word that's been around a really long time. And I like to provoke a conversation about it because a lot of people think serving others is like soft and you like hug everybody and it's all happy, happy. But the hard part of servant leadership is thinking about others more often than yourself. And if you think about how hard that is to do, when we come to work in the morning, we're all focused on ourselves, what our day is going to look like, what we've got to get done, what's important to us. And then to go into your first meeting and say, okay, all I'm going to think about right now is you, that is really hard to do. And so the test in my mind of a servant leader is if they can set aside all that natural me, me, me stuff and say, okay, now I'm here to serve this team who's assembled to make some decision for this business. And I've got to give them my very best, but I've got to think about how to set them up for success and make sure that the outcome is good for the people. There's a great quote from Jim Collins who says, a great leader has a terrifying iron will and ambition for the people and the enterprise, not for themselves. And that's a powerful definition of what a servant leader looks like.
Until I read in your book, and with all of the cross-references to the pieces in the media, I had no idea that one of the reasons that Popeyes sort of sets itself apart from other franchise businesses is because of your relationship with the franchise owners. But traditionally, franchise owners have often been at odds with the franchise itself.
That is absolutely true. And it was true at Popeyes in 2007 when I came to this company. There was almost outright warfare between the franchise owners and the franchisor, who was the corporate owner. And they were not aligned, they were not working together, and they were not enjoying any kind of success. And as I look back on that, one of the decisions we made that really set us apart from our competitors is we made the health of that relationship a top priority. I call it choosing whom we would serve. And we said we would only measure our success by their success. So we asked franchise owners, what's important to you? They said, we need to make money for this to work. Simple, clear, measurable. And we said, okay, we will start measuring the profitability of every restaurant, and we will only consider ourselves a success if that profitability improves. It improved from 17% restaurant operating profit to this year, it's about 23% restaurant operating profit. Our sales have grown, our customer experience has improved, and they're making more money. Proof that we have learned to work in an aligned, collaborative fashion with our owners. I'll tell you one more secret weapon is we actually decided that we love franchisees. Now, that also may need to be obvious, but it's not in this business. We've decided to treat them with respect, to listen to their ideas, to work with them together to solve problems instead of telling them we're so smart we have the answer. And that collaboration slows us down at the beginning. But boy, once we agree, we go fast.
Anybody who has followed the brand is familiar with some pretty drastic changes that you've made. I mean, my goodness, you changed the name of the company. You
know, yes, we did.
And you all thought you had it all figured out with a new restaurant design, but that didn't work out, did it?
No, we started with changing the name to Louisiana Kitchen, Popeyes Louisiana Kitchen, to give us a wider berth for product innovation and really owning our Louisiana roots. And that part wasn't too hard because it didn't cost any money to change the name initially. But when it came time to remodel the restaurants, that's big capital. That's an investment on the part of the owners. When we first brought to them the idea of remodeling, they didn't like the design. They thought it was too expensive, and they thought it was premature because our sales were still not positive. And they said to us, you know what? Take a pause, bring us a better design for half the money, and get sales up, and then we'll talk. Well, most teams like mine would have said, I'm mad. I'm going to argue with you. I'm going to win this case. But I'm so grateful my team had the courage and the humility to go back home and regroup. And they said, you know what? We're going to do just that. We're going to get a design that they like. We're going to find a way to make it cheaper. And we're going to wait another 2 years till sales are cranking good. And then we'll bring it back. And because we listened and followed their lead, we brought back a remodel that they did swiftly throughout our system.
Is it still a valid number that you currently have about 300 franchise owners?
Yes.
And how many Popeyes are there in the world right now?
2,500.
I remember the first time somebody told me how many Popeyes you have in Korea.
We have 100 in Korea, to be exact, and we have about 130 in the country of Turkey.
130 in Turkey. Is it all just delicious fried chicken? Or when you go into other cultures with a franchise concept, how much do you have to alter the concept?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We really think we're exporting this amazing Louisiana food to the world, and the world loves chicken, loves seafood, loves spice, and loves rice. And that's what we sell. And so you'd be amazed. The core menu is identical in flavor, profile, and preparation everywhere in the world. Now, we do tweak side dishes. We, for example, in Korea, they absolutely hate coleslaw, so we don't sell it. There's no point. They eat kimchi, a very spicy fermented cabbage, and that's their version of cabbage. And so we adjust the menu to local taste. We'll offer unique sauces, dipping sauces, for example. Some countries like sandwiches, so we might have a spicy chicken sandwich in addition to our famous bona fide bone-in chicken. Adaptations, yes, but the core is exactly what you would expect if you were eating on Canal Street in New Orleans. We love the fact that foodies love our food, and we're so proud to be able to serve the kind of food that a chef appreciates, the preparation, the flavor, the complexity of red beans and rice. You know, Paul Prudhomme used to say that that's the best red beans and rice on the planet. I can't make it better. And so we're proud to be part of that culinary heritage and hope we always live up to it for our guests.
Cheryl Batchelder, CEO of Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and author of Dare to Serve. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we go into the kitchen with Chef John Besh and learn what dinner's like at his house.
That's truly what does bring us all together in Southeast Louisiana, is that food. Black, white, red, yellow, we all love our gumbo. We all love the etouffees, and we all love oyster stew.
Miss an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant, serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.